Obscura is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it. So, your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com. to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Listener, did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern that you can think of. I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, PMS support to ease cramps and balance mood swings, or their sexual euphoria gummies to help you feel ready for action and turn every touch into a full-body experience. Listen. You can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get to the perfect mood. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, listeners get 20% off their first order with code Obscura. Head to Mood.com, find your functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code Obscura when you check out to save 20% off your first order. Listener, released with this episode is going to be a free fireside chat, and I'm going to release one next episode as well. Just to give you guys a taste of what you're missing on the Patreon that just isn't Black Label, because there's other stuff that gets released there too. If you'd like to hear more, head to patreon.com/obscurecrimepodcast. If not, just enjoy the episodes and the fireside chat. Listener, the story of Tina Brown does not begin with a crime scene or a siren piercing the night. It begins with a child learning far too early that safety is something other people have, and that home can be a place where the shadows linger long after sunrise. In North Chicago, in the summer of 1970, Tina entered the world to teenage parents who were already slipping into a rhythm of clubs, drugs, and nights lost to alcohol. What she received from them was not a childhood, but a long apprenticeship in survival. While other children learned to read and ride their bikes, Tina Brown was learning how to keep her younger brother fed and clean. She was learning how to walk him to school while she carried the weight of two small lives on her shoulders, not yet old enough to bear it. What followed were the kinds of moments that stain a life permanently, moments that breed silence, fear, and anger. When a father begins to confuse his role, when a grandmother rejects the truth of her granddaughter's suffering, when a household is so steeped in drugs and violence that the children wander the streets because the world outside feels safer than the walls inside. Tina Brown did not grow up. She endured. Every year added a new layer of damage. Every betrayal became another lesson that the adults responsible for her were incapable of protecting anyone, least of all her. By the time she fled that home at 15, she was a child with no childhood left. She drifted between relatives who either could not or would not help her find stability. School became a revolving door. Rules felt like chains. Love felt inconsistent, sharp, and temporary. And at every stop along the way, drugs breathed down her neck like an old companion, waiting for the collapse. She found men who mirrored her past, partners who dragged her deeper into addiction. A world where a newborn child could come into the world already carrying cocaine in its bloodstream. A world where she traded her body for substances that briefly quieted the memory she could not outrun. Her life a cycle of relapse, recovery, hope, disappointment, and the constant search for a version of herself that had never been given a chance to exist. For brief moments, she found stability. She worked. She loved. She cared for her daughter. She tried. But every step forward seemed to come with an equal force dragging her back into the undertow. Heartbreak shredded what little resilience she had managed to rebuild. The loss of yet another relationship set her spiraling once more, and the life she had struggled for slipped out from under her like wet pavement in the rain. By 2009, Tina Brown was nearing the end of a long road paved with trauma, addiction, desperation, ghosts of every night she had wandered the streets as a forgotten child. She moved to Florida in search of a fresh start, but the past followed her like a shadow that refused to fade. It was a life unraveling thread by thread. You see, in true crime, we often look for the moment when someone crosses a line. The moment when a person shifts from troubled to dangerous, from victim to perpetrator, from wounded to lethal. But with Tina Brown, that moment cannot be separated from the decades that shaped her. The violence she later committed did not appear from nowhere. It grew slowly, painfully, in the gaps where love should have been, in the places where safety never lived, in the long corridors of trauma she walked through alone. This is the story of how a girl born into chaos became a woman capable of creating her own. A story carved from neglect, shaped by violence, and fueled by the kind of desperation that can make night and nightmare feel indistinguishable. Before the crime comes the life, and Tina Brown's life is a map of every dark turn that led her to the moment that the world would finally learn her name.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Tina, you know, can I call you Tina?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Obviously know something's up.
Yeah.
So, tell me what happened tonight.
Nothing happened that I know of. Heather just said that something about Adriana got beat up real bad.
Okay. You don't know anything about that?
No.
See your arms and hands if I could. Okay. Can I see the top signs? Mm-hmm. Okay. Those old scars on there?
Yeah, I have a puppy.
Okay. And what's this right here? That little scratch there.
This?
Yeah.
I have a puppy.
Okay, and your puppy calls that?
Look, I'm going to move here.
Got your chin? Okay.
Nothing new.
All right. So, where were you tonight?
At Heather's.
At Heather's house?
Well, I was at home. My daughter's braided my hair, so I was at home, but it started hurting, and her little friend started coming by. So, Heather said she was going to cook, so I went down there. She was cooking fish and french fries, and then we just started watching movies.
Okay. And did you go anywhere from there?
Mm-mm.
You were there all night until the cops came up there?
Mm-hmm.
What time did you go over there?
Probably just started getting dark.
Okay, so about sunset.
Willie Coleman Sr. and Lily were barely out of childhood when they made the decision to marry. It is easy to imagine two teenagers swept up in something they believed was love. Carrying more hope than understanding, unaware that the years ahead would demand a kind of steadiness neither one yet possessed. In North Chicago on July 19th, 1970, Lily gave birth to her first child, a baby girl they named Tina. The world she entered was already unstable, already drifting towards the margins. 11 months later, Lily gave birth again, this time to a son named Willie Coleman Jr. And the small family grew in size, even as its foundation weakened beneath them. People who watched the young couple from the outside tried to make sense of them. Some insisted that Willie Sr. and Lily were hard workers, that they showed signs of trying to build a life. Others described them in far harsher terms. They remembered them as partiers, as people more devoted to the nightlife than to parenthood, drawn to clubs where alcohol flowed freely, and drugs were easy to find. Nights blurred into mornings and weekends dissolved into stretches of intoxication. leaving little time or energy for the children who waited at home. In this environment, Tina Brown and her brother did not simply grow up. They endured.
What has been going on between you and Adriana this week?
Adriana, me and Adriana were together today.
Okay. Where were y'all together?
At my house.
Okay. What was going on there?
We were just sitting there watching movies, trying to get my computer. The man next door has a computer, put a virus on my computer. So my daughter is the only one who knows how to pull it up where I can get iTunes and watch movies. So Adriana was over there, and she was actually Adriana and another white guy named James. They were trying to pull the iTunes up on my computer.
Okay.
And she had went and got some 3 naked movies from my house to ask him, did he want to buy them?
Okay. Have y'all had any problems?
Oh, yeah. We've had problems. The first 3 trailers, we've had problems for a long time.
What's the problems?
Well, lately, the new problem is she thinks that I'm the one who had her boyfriend locked up in jail.
Okay, so she's mad at you thinking her boyfriend's locked up because of you.
Yeah, but we talked about it earlier today.
Okay. But y'all getting along today, no problems?
Yeah.
Because their parents followed this pattern, Tina Brown and Willie Jr. learned early what it meant to be left behind. The children were often left alone or dropped off at homes of relatives for days at a time. Sometimes they found themselves at their uncle's house from Friday evening into Sunday night, two small figures waiting for the moment their father decided to return. In these fragmented arrangements, Tina stepped almost immediately into a role no child should have to fill. She became the caretaker. She made meals for her younger brother. She dressed him for school. She walked him through the neighborhood, watching over him with the protective instinct of someone who had already learned that the world could be dangerous. She checked his homework, held his hand, and did her best to give him the sense of structure she never received from their parents. Willie Jr. spent 90% of his time with Tina, and people later said she essentially raised him. What should have been a sisterly bond became something born out of necessity and self-sacrifice.
This morning, I was trying to make some phone calls, and I wanted to heat up some chicken, so I asked her would she put the church's chicken in her microwave, and she heated it up for me and brought it to my house.
Okay. Do you know what happened to Adriana tonight?
No, I don't. Heather just said she got beat up, but that's all I know.
A little bit more than that. We're not sure if she's going to make it or not.
No, I don't.
But she talked to us, or she talked to the people that came over to help her.
Mm-hmm.
And she told them something. You know what she told them?
I could just imagine what's that. Mm.
She said that you and Heather did this to her. So that's why we're talking to you two.
Shortly before Tina's 12th birthday, the fragile illusion of stability shattered completely. In front of both children, Willie Sr. beat Lily severely. The violence was brutal enough that Lily fled, unable to remain in the home any longer. Soon after, the marriage ended in divorce between Lily and Willie. That night had scared Lily and Tina too much. The beating he gave both of them so severe. Instead of finding solace, Tina was confronted with more upheaval. Lily was charged with child abandonment after the two had ran away for their own safety. But her mother fell into drugs, leaving Tina alone to fend for herself. And in a devastating turn, that placed custody of Tina and Willie Jr. into the hands of the man who was already using and selling drugs from his home. And after Lily left, the abuse inside that house changed form, but did not end. It only grew darker, listener. With the mother gone, Tina's father began to sexually abuse her. It is impossible to calculate what happens inside a child when the person meant to protect her instead inflicts the deepest kind of violation. Tina carried the fear in her body. Others began to notice. Her uncle suspected something was terribly wrong. He saw that Tina recoiled around Willie Sr., and he witnessed the unsettling dynamic between father and daughter. According to him, Willie Sr. behaved towards Tina as if she were not his child, but someone he claimed instead. Tina eventually attempted to confide in her paternal grandmother, probably clinging to some faint hope that some adult out there might help her. Instead, she was met with denial and rage. Her grandmother refused to believe that her son could commit such an act. She hurled Tina out of the household, commanding her never to return. The rejection sealed another door in her life, a life already filled with locked rooms.
But she said I called. She's been saying a lot of stuff lately.
Okay.
She said I called, because this is all stuff that we talked about today at my house.
Okay.
About somebody supposed to have called Crime Stoppers on her about her kids. And I told her I didn't do it. You know, I would never do it, but she said people around the trailer park have been telling her that. And my tire was stabbed.
Okay.
And I asked her if she did it. She said no. I mean, I couldn't prove she did it. So I didn't argue about it, fuss about it, or nothing.
But you thought she did it?
Mm-hmm. Just because of what people said, but...
Mm-hmm. Did you hear about her window getting busted out?
Whose window?
Adriana's window getting busted out a few days ago. You didn't hear about it?
No, sir, I didn't.
Did you know the police came out there last week to talk to her about the problems she had in her neighborhood?
Yeah, they talked to me, too.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you were there.
Mm-hmm.
What was the problem?
Her and my... another girl come out there to fight Adriana, because Adriana was supposed to have gotten smart with her on the phone.
Okay.
And Adriana's boyfriend was there, Andre Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent Adriana in the house. No, he came outside the house, and he was saying that I was in the middle of that, which I didn't even know the white girl. And he said, he cussed all the kids out and me that was outside. And he told Adriana to go in the house and get that thing or whatever. She came back outside on the porch. She's on the porch cussing. And she came out in the walkway and she tried to tase my daughter.
Who tried to tase your daughter?
Adriana.
Adriana got a taser?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of taser?
I just think it was a black one.
A black one?
She said that.
You seen it?
Yeah, everybody out there saw it. I just know it was black.
Okay.
And it made a loud noise.
Okay.
Everybody out there saw it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The sexual abuse ceased only when Willie Sr. began a relationship with a woman named Melinda, who soon became his second wife. The end of that particular nightmare did not bring safety. Once Melinda entered the household, the environment grew even more chaotic. Family members urged Willie Sr. to leave her. They described Melinda as sexually promiscuous, physically aggressive, heavily dependent on alcohol, and a frequent abuser of drugs. Their warnings went unheard. On many nights, Willie Sr. and Melinda locked themselves in the bedroom for hours with alcohol and drugs, while Tina Brown and her brother wandered through a neighborhood known for gangs and violence. These children walked the streets aimlessly because there was nowhere else to go. Home was not a refuge. It was merely a place where danger wore familiar faces. Melinda drank every day. Alcohol sharpened her temper, turning her into someone verbally abusive and unpredictable. Although Tina and Melinda initially shared a brief period of companionship, their relationship decayed with startling speed. Melinda introduced Tina to drugs and later forced her to engage in sexual intercourse with men in exchange for money to fund those drugs.
Why would she say that you and Heather did this to her?
Well, from what Heather telling me, that Adriana is jealous. Adriana told me that the stuff that's supposed to have been going, that she heard from Heather that I was the one who called children, the DCFS people,
mm-hmm.
on her.
Well, certainly that would, certainly I could see some animosity going on there. And of course, you think that she stabbed her tire. But the problem I see here is she may not live. And she is saying that you and Heather did this to her. So that's probably pretty important at this point.
I've been talking to an officer. Every time there's an accusation being said about me, mm-hmm. or anything being said in that trailer park, I talk to an officer, Morale,
mm-hmm.
over at the work release place.
Okay.
That's what I've been talking to about any kind of, because first they were saying that they were coming to get me and my daughter, that aunt, not Adriana, but the boy she was going with was sending people after me and my daughter. Adriana was saying that I was the one who sent him to jail, which I did do it.
Okay.
Okay, because he had threatened my daughter.
Okay.
Okay.
You seem kind of lackadaisical about this. I'm telling you that this woman is probably going to die and has named you as the person that's harmed her. It kind of, you know, doesn't sit easy with me that you're just so nonchalant about this.
Their father added another layer of terror. When high, he sometimes beat the children, not because they disobeyed, but because he seemed entertained by the pain. He would grab belts or clothes hangers and lash them without warning. These assaults arrived suddenly, as if violence had become his pastime. By 15, Tina Brown could no longer survive in her father's home. It had all become too much. She was too afraid. She left, stepping into a world that offered its own dangers, but at least spared her the cruelty inside those walls. After she left, the house continued to function as a hub in a gang-related drug operation, with Willie Sr. serving as an enforcer. Eventually, the FBI investigated him. He was arrested and served a year in prison, yet even this consequence did little to repair the damage already done. For a short time, Tina tried to live with her mother again, but they clashed constantly. Their relationship had become so fractured that they behaved more like siblings than a parent and child, fighting until the situation became untenable. Her mother forced her out, and Tina moved to her aunt's home. These years were marked by instability. Tina attended 4 different schools in 4 years. She left high school for a year, adrift in the turbulence of her life, but eventually returned and earned her diploma. It was a rare accomplishment in a period filled with turmoil. After drifting between relatives and temporary places to stay, Tina moved into a drug house. It was here that she met Greg Miller, the man who would father her 3 children. Their relationship was steeped in drugs, alcohol, violence. Tina later reported that domestic abuse occurred during their time together. Her first child was born cocaine positive, a tragic culmination of addiction and desperation. After her second child arrived, she became pregnant again. And during the 3rd pregnancy, Tina ended her relationship with Greg Miller and entered a substance abuse treatment facility. Her 3rd child, Brittany Miller, was born inside that facility. As part of her treatment agreement, she allowed her mother to adopt her 2 sons. It was another painful separation in a life already filled with them, handing away 2 of her sons to the woman that had already taken so much from her.
I just talked to her today and I told her I never called DCFS on
the kids. Okay. Well, she's probably going to die is the word we're getting. And we're concerned over that. And the last person she said that did this to her is you and Heather. Okay. We're going to go out there. We know what happened out there. It's just going to be a matter of getting fingerprints and evidence back. Okay.
Out where? It happened at her house?
No. We didn't hear... It didn't.
It originated, started at her house.
Right.
And then it went somewhere else.
What started at her house?
The reason we're here.
Basically, what she told the fireman was that you two came and grabbed her.
Mm-hmm. Well, say what now?
What she told the fireman was that you two came over and grabbed her, pulled her out of that house, beat her, and harmed her.
And nobody out there, the kids, or nobody saw none of this.
Nobody saw it. We talked to everybody in that neighborhood.
Kids are always outside.
We've talked to everybody in the neighborhood.
And
you saw them all out there.
Did nobody hear
nothing? Nope. Mm-hmm. And she's saying that y'all did it.
Well, she said I called DCFS on her. She said I put her boyfriend in jail. Well,
apparently she was right about that.
Only one did I put her husband in jail, but I didn't call DCFS on her. Because most of the time that we was together, we was getting hot together.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got some issues, okay? Mm-hmm. And we're going to get to the bottom of it one way or another, okay? Mm-hmm. So, we're sitting here talking to you, and I'd certainly appreciate, and I know Tom appreciates that you're talking to us.
Okay.
But we got to get to the bottom of this, and we got to know what happened, the truth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's two choices here. Either you're going to tell us, or Heather's going to tell us. So, who's going to be?
After leaving treatment, Tina managed to remain drug-free for 4 years. She spent those years raising Brittany, attempting to carve out stability. She met another man and married him, but their life together unraveled quickly when he was convicted of selling drugs. Tina found work as a bartender and eventually met another man, her third significant relationship, someone who also dealt drugs. Their two-year relationship was stained by domestic violence. Even though Tina remained sober throughout, stability seemed to hover just out of reach for her. Close enough to imagine, never close enough to hold. When this boyfriend was arrested for selling drugs, Tina's fragile financial situation totally collapsed. She accumulated multiple speeding tickets she could not afford to pay. Her driver's license was suspended. She was criminally charged with writing worthless checks. Faced with mounting bills and dwindling options, she began stripping to survive. Under the weight of all these pressures, Tina relapsed on cocaine. She needed something. She didn't want to strip. She didn't like the prying eyes of other men. She saw her dad in that audience. This relapse became a long descent that lasted nearly 9 years. 9 years that burnt out something inside her that held on for a time, but eventually had to let go. And during that time, she was mostly homeless, broke, surviving through sex work in order to fund her addictions. Life became a cycle of desperation, a series of choices shaped by survival rather than desire. She wrote more worthless checks and was ordered into another court-mandated treatment program. She completed the program around the age of 30. Remarkably, she found employment that offered her stability. She worked her way up the ranks until she became a manager. For 4 years, she lived a life that resembled some level of normalcy. In fact, some could say she was doing pretty well, and her sons visited her regularly. It was a flicker of light, an otherwise bleak landscape.
I didn't do anything to her.
Okay.
I promised to God.
And you were home all night.
I was at Heather's house.
Okay. You were at Heather's all night. Never left there. Is Brittany having any problems with Adriana?
Not that I know of. We were all in my house.
Well, the rumor going around the neighborhood is that Brittany busted out Adriana's window a couple days ago. The one busted out of her trailer. The one right there in the middle of the living room.
In the living room?
Well, yeah, that's
Adriana,
what the...
No, baby.
Not that one?
No, honey.
Which window
No is? Window was broke out. Adriana's husband broke that window out. Adriana was at... Okay. How'd that go? Adriana was at my... No, Adriana and her husband was at my... No, me and Adriana's husband was at my house first. We were smoking crack, okay? Mm-hmm. Then Adriana came over there, and we were smoking crack. But he didn't want Adriana to have none. So I said that he had to go, okay? When he left, he cussed Adriana out. Adriana was at my house that night because he was talking about he was going to do something to her. So he said he was going to put her out. So I said, well, Adriana and the kids can come to my house. They can stay. They're not going to be homeless, okay? Mm-hmm. So she was over there for a long time. He kept coming, knocking on my door. I said, you got to stop doing that. You know, I kept acting like I was calling the police. But Adriana knew I wasn't calling the police, okay? He kept coming over there, knocking on my door. Then he was standing outside on their back porch, and he was yelling, Adriana, get your mother fucking ass over here. Adriana kept going out to the porch talking to him, The last time he came over and knocked on my door, Adriana, I said, Adriana, you and the kids gotta go, okay? Mm-hmm. She went to the house, and I guess they got to arguing and fighting in the living room. He broke that window out. That window's been broke for a long time, sir.
Okay. What about
just
another
like
window?
Told,
maybe I don't. Maybe I'm looking at the wrong window.
What are you talking about, honey?
Darren's telling me he heard Brittany broke out of the window this week. You didn't hear about that?
No.
Okay.
And why she didn't tell the police that then?
Don't know. I mean, you yourself don't tell the police much.
Brittany didn't break out that window.
Okay. Why?
I mean, she was just at my house today. Why she didn't tell me?
Why is Adriana saying you and Heather did this to her?
I don't know.
That's serious business.
I've been blamed for a lot. Well, it's a cycle over there. It goes trailer one, trailer two, trailer
well,
three,
well, she didn't do it
four.
To herself. Somebody did it to her.
Adriana been riding that bike all day today.
Okay. But somebody did it to her.
I didn't.
Okay.
I swear I didn't.
But she's saying you did it.
I didn't. Adriana been saying I didn't. I did
it may
a
be
lot
the last
stuff.
Thing she tells somebody. You know?
Listen to her. I want to take a moment to recommend another podcast called Mind of a Monster, The Killer Nurse. Mind of a Monster is a podcast series from ID that drives into the minds of notorious serial killers like Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, and more. This season, they explore the chilling story of Kristen Gilbert, a nurse who murders four of her patients between 1989 and 1995, and is suspected of killing dozens more. Criminal psychologist Dr. Michelle Ward takes us inside Kristen's twisted mind, uncovering why she kills and how she manages to do it right in front of her colleagues. The entire season is out right now, so you can binge it wherever you get your podcasts. And coming up next, they're covering Israel Keyes, a serial killer who picks his victims at random across the U.S. and covers his tracks with terrifying precision. That new season drops early next year. Don't miss it. Listener, if you like Obscura, you'll definitely enjoy Mind of a Monster, The Killer Nurse. Listen to Mind of a Monster, The Killer Nurse, wherever you get your podcasts. Listener, Chime is changing the way people bank. Fee-free and smarter banking built for you, not just the 1%. Chime isn't just another banking app. They unlock smarter banking for everyday people with products like MyPay, giving you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime and getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. Some old banks still don't do this. Forget overdraft fees, minimum balance fees, and monthly fees. Chime makes your everyday spending work harder by delivering real rewards and financial progress. Earn up to 3.5% APY on savings, 8 times higher than traditional banks. And Chime is rated 5 stars by USA Today for customer service. Real humans, 24/7. And Chime also has the Chime Card, the new card that unlocks safer credit building and cash back with everyday spending. Together, at last. There's no annual fees, no interest, and no strings attached. And when you get qualifying direct deposits, you get 1.5% cash back on eligible Chime Card purchases. My younger self would have benefited so much from this. Chime is not just smarter banking. It is the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/obscura. That is chime.com/obscura.
Maybe the last word she said. We call that a dying declaration.
I called on Dre. I didn't call DCFS on her kids. I'm not going to take the blame for this.
Then the light dimmed again. Tina discovered that her boyfriend was cheating on her with her brother's girlfriend. The revelation cracked something inside her. Something broke internally. The emotional trauma was immediately overwhelming, dredging up years of buried betrayal and pain. She left her job, wrote more worthless checks, and slipped back into another relapse. This relapse was brief, lasting about a month, but it disrupted something. Every little something that happened to her, every betrayal, it took something else away. And something changed in her here, something that her family members and friends would later comment on. It was that fourth relationship where part of her empathy, whatever remained of it, seemingly faded, and Tina became an entirely different person. In the summer of 2009, Tina tried once again to rebuild a life. She enrolled in an online college classes. She was tired, but she was trying.
If you know anything and you're withholding it, you want to be the first one on board. Okay? You see what I'm talking about? Because once we get everybody to, you know, get all the information, there's not going to be any second chances.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, if she doesn't make it,
you're trying to be sleeping with a lot of girls, well, a lot of guys around
that.
There.
I realize that.
One of them could have did it.
But what you don't understand is the last statements that she said before she went out.
Went out where?
I'm sorry?
Went out where?
Went unconscious.
Didn't do it. I promised to come.
Then you better start coming up with some facts.
The only thing I know is today is the first day me and Adriana talked in a long time. And I'm thinking that the only reason that we did talk today because Heather wasn't around in the beginning. It seemed like she kind of get rocks in her jaws when Heather come around. Just like I was telling, I believe Adriana stabbed my tire. I can't prove it, but I believe somebody put her up to it. She ain't no hard person. She only act like that when she get around one person. And that's the one who's been putting a wedge in between us. He really don't have no family here.
She moved to Pensacola, Florida, hoping the distance would give her a fresh start. Pensacola, Florida, often presents itself with a kind of gentle brightness. The shoreline glows beneath soft morning light. The water moves with an easy rhythm that calms even the most unsettled of minds. The air carries the scent of salt and warm sand, reminding visitors that this place once drew people in search of rest. Neighborhoods near the coast feel peaceful enough to suggest possibility. On good days, the city seems almost tender, a place where someone might try to start again, someone broken, wanting to be fixed. Pensacola can feel like a quiet promise. But listener, promises can be deceiving. Behind the postcard surface lies a different version of the city, a version of the city left for those that can't live near the coast. Once you move away from the sunlight on the water, you find neighborhoods where poverty clings to the walls of old houses. The streets carry the weight of lives stretched thin. Addiction gathers in corners behind convenience stores. Violence flickers through certain blocks after dark. There are people who wander with slack desperation of those who have run out of places to go. The heat presses down in a way that feels less like warmth and more like a reminder that escape is not guaranteed. Pensacola is a place where beauty and decay sit side by side. A place where the beach suggests renewal, while the inner city whispers a quieter truth. You can't win. You can't be fixed. There's no turning back the clock. It's too late for you. Many who come there looking for a new beginning eventually collide with the same pressures they hoped to outrun. It is a city shaped by contradiction. It nourishes dreams while quietly eroding them. It holds both hope and a slow pull of despair, waiting to see which one a person will answer to.
We talked to you earlier about the taser.
I told you about a taser.
Uh-huh. What'd you tell me about that taser?
That, Brittany and the day that, a white girl came over to fight Adriana.
Mm-hmm.
That, Andre told Adriana to go get that thing, and she went in the house and got a taser.
Okay.
Tried to tase Brittany with it.
Okay. What about the taser that was over at your house today?
Taser at my house?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about it.
You don't know about a taser at your house?
No, sir.
I've been told about a taser at your house.
I didn't know it was there.
You don't know anything about it, huh?
No, sir, I don't.
And you stayed over at
Heather's
house, mm-hmm, from when she started cooking until the cops came?
She was already cooking when I got there.
Okay.
She was frying.
And it was already. About what time?
About when the sun started going down.
Okay. And you didn't go anywhere. You just stayed over there.
I didn't go nowhere until Brittany showed me her hand, but we were on the porch. I didn't ever go nowhere.
You were at the porch at Heather's house?
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't go nowhere.
Okay. Because that ain't what I'm told.
Where was I supposed to go?
Apparently you went back to your house. You were gone for half an hour to an hour, and you come back right before the cops and say, hey, the cops are outside. Don't answer the door.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Now, who was I supposed to have told that to, though?
Heather. That's what Heather's telling me.
And I thought you said me and Heather was together.
Not according to Heather. That's what you told me.
You told me that me and Heather was together.
No, you told me you and Heather was together.
You said that Adriana said me and Heather did this to her.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's exactly what she said.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what she said.
So how then am I going to be able to run and tell Heather, don't open the door, the police are outside if me and Heather were together, supposed to be beaten?
No, that's what Heather told me. Heather said that you left her house for half an hour to an hour.
It wasn't.
You come back and say, hey, the cops are outside. Don't answer the door.
Then and you start chain smoking. You guys would have saw me.
I didn't see you. I wasn't the choke out there.
Well, that's when the police would have saw me then, right?
Maybe. I don't know if they would have seen you sneaking into the front door. I don't know.
I mean, I got a white shirt on. Why would I? How could I be
pissed? That doesn't mean they necessarily saw you. Cops miss plenty of people running around. But the problem I have is, now Heather ain't even back in your story. She's saying you gone for half an hour
it
to an hour.
Half an hour. I mean, I did. I was on her porch, but I was just looking at my daughter's hand.
Okay. What's wrong with your daughter's hand?
She said her hand was swollen, said she thinks she had broke her hand.
Did Heather's telling me that she always has to protect Adriana from you and your daughter. Mm-hmm. You and your daughter chasing around all over the place. Your daughter has a taser. She saw the taser over at your house today.
My baby don't have a taser. We never had a taser.
I don't know. That's what she's telling me. Why is she telling me that?
I don't know. We never had a taser, sir.
Okay.
Adriana had a taser. We never had a taser. My baby was tased.
Y'all's stories she are getting further taser. And further apart.
Like I said, Adriana tried to tase Brittany with the taser. Brittany has a scratch across her chest right here.
Mm-hmm.
That I was grabbing Brittany from off the porch so that they wouldn't fight. Okay? We never had a taser.
Let's get back to Brittany's hand. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So Brittany comes up and says her hand's hurt and she's going to go to the emergency room.
And she said, Mama, would you take me to the emergency room? And I said, for what, Brittany?
Mm-hmm.
She showed me her hand. She said, look at my hand, Ma.
And what did you see?
I said, yeah, it swole up. What did you do to it?
Mm-hmm.
She said, you going to take me to the emergency room? I said, no. You can go.
Did you say how that happened?
Yeah, I did, but I don't remember what she said. I thought she said she hit a wall or something. I'm not mistaken.
Heather's saying you're gone for half an hour to an hour tonight.
I was not gone for no
after
half
dinner.
An hour to an hour.
And you come back right before the cops are over there. Cops are over there around 10 o'clock. So from 9 to 10, I got you unaccounted for. I asked Heather if you were over at her house, and she said yes, you came over around dinner time.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said you left for half an hour to an hour. And that when you come back, when you come back, you come in a hurry, nervous, saying the cops are outside, don't answer the door. Why is Heather telling me this?
You tell me. If me and Heather were together doing this, then how is Heather going to be already in the house and I'm not in the house?
Don't know. Maybe she's lying on you too.
I mean, you said that Miss Adriana said that me and Heather did it to her, right?
Well, so she said you now. And your daughter and a Heather.
Okay.
She didn't have a last name for Heather, though. So maybe there's another Heather out there. She knew your name.
I'm not
she knew your first and last name.
I told you we were best friends in that trailer park in the beginning.
That's funny because Heather says that her and Adriana are best friends and that you and Adriana don't get along and that you and Adriana are constantly having problems and that you and your daughter have been chasing Adriana around this trailer park,
no.
trying to hurt her, and that you have a taser in your house,
no.
and that taser was Brittany's taser,
oh
and that Brittany had chased
there is, when the police
Adriana
come out
around.
There.
Tina took a job at Waffle House, yet by Thanksgiving, another collapse had begun. Financial strain tightened around her. She relapsed again and left her job. In her desperation, Tina began sex work again to afford her addiction to drugs, eventually sleeping with a woman named Heather Lee's husband. It was a return to a survival strategy she had used during the darkest periods of her life. Listener, when the time finally came to examine Tina Brown's mind, it was not done with the urgency of saving her. It was done after her life had already spiraled into crimes so horrifying that the state of Florida would speak her name with a shudder. The analysis that followed was not a rescue. It was an autopsy of a dark psyche, a slow uncovering of wounds that had been festering for decades. To understand Tina Brown, investigators and experts had to trace the long shadow that stretched behind her. They spoke with the people who had watched her grow in the margins. They interviewed her mother, her aunt, her two uncles, her brother, and the two sons who carried pieces of her story in their memories. Each voice added another layer to a tragic portrait. They did not speak of one trauma, but of many. They spoke of a childhood riddled with neglect, of nights spent in danger, of a father who crossed lines no parent should ever approach, and of a home where fear became a routine. Records filled in for them what words could not. Medical files documented physical harm and the fallout of addiction. Academic reports showed a girl who moved through schools like a ghost passing through hallways. She never stayed long enough to truly occupy. Legal documents showed the paper trail of spirals, relapses, survival decisions that carried heavy consequences. Time spent in and out of jail, sometimes prison. And psychological tests revealed the fractures beneath the surface. The places where her mind had learned to bend under pressure instead of breaking. Taken together, these pieces formed a grim understanding of Tina Brown's internal world. She'd grown up in an environment so steeped in violence and instability that her brain adapted in ways meant to protect her, but that would later betray her. She lived with post-traumatic stress disorder, born from repeated violations and constant danger. She carried with her repressed memories and depression that settled into her bones, a heaviness that no amount of willpower could shake. Anxiety threaded through her daily life like a taut wire, pulling her tight. And beneath it all, rage smoldered, a natural consequence of years spent powerless, unheard, and unprotected. Her parents had given her an upbringing that barely deserved the name. Neglect was the air she breathed. There was no stable foundation, no safety net here. Nothing to prevent her from falling again and again into the same cycles that defined her youth. The damage inflicted during her early years did not fade with time. It grew with her, stretching through adolescence and adulthood, like the roots of a tree that had not been poisoned, but uprooted entirely, shaping something withered, twisted, cruel, never having a chance to grow straight. If for all this darkness, there was something unsettling in the findings. Tina Brown was not consumed by madness. She did not drift through life unable to distinguish fantasy from reality. She thought clearly, not darkly. She behaved logically. She understood the world around her, and she responded to it with rational awareness. There was no indication of bipolar disorder, no signs of schizophrenia, no grand mood disorder to blame for what she would eventually do. She was scarred, but not lost to delusion. Her primary diagnosis in the end was dependence on crack cocaine, a dependency muted only because incarceration had removed the drug from her reach. But beneath that dependency lingered something deeper, something harder to place. It doesn't necessarily carry a diagnosis. It was a lifetime of unhealed wounds and a mind shaped by damage rather than any disorder with an academic name. A heart that had been forced to operate under siege for too long. Listener, sometimes a person is not driven to violence by madness, but by the accumulated weight of a life that has taught them pain more thoroughly than it ever taught them peace or love. Tina Brown did not stumble into darkness by accident. She walked there along a path carved for her by trauma, sorrow, addiction, pain. And when she finally committed the crime that would bind her name to horror, it was not the act of someone who did not understand. It was the terrible conclusion of a life spent navigating a world that never gave her a chance to be anything else. Listener, there comes a point in stories like this when the past begins to feel heavier than the present. When the listener starts to sense that a life formed in fire rarely cools without consequence. Tina Brown's childhood is not a prelude. It is a slow construction of an inner world shaped by fear, where she was at home with cruelty. It is tempting to look away from the debris left behind, yet these fragments are important. They reveal forces that molded her. They show us how a person can spend decades trying to outrun the inevitable. As we follow Tina through the chaos of her early years, through the violations she endured and the betrayal that hardened her, something became clear. Survival became her only map. Every choice made in adulthood was layered over the broken foundation of her childhood. Hope flickered through her life at uneven intervals, but it never stayed long enough to become a guide. Each moment of stability snapped under the weight of her history, and the cycle began again. There's a kind of tragedy in this pattern, listener. A rhythm of collapse that seems almost inevitable when the first lesson a child learns is hate. Yet, inevitability is not the same thing as fate. I don't want to dismiss what she did. People reach crossroads. They choose, they fall. They return to the same dark corners they once tried to escape. Tina Brown's life reminds us that suffering can both shield and be a weapon, and a person can be shaped by brutality until they no longer recognize the line between harm suffered and harm afflicted. When the past remains unresolved, it does not stay behind. It travels with you, listener. It mutates, it whispers. It becomes a companion that refuses silence. This is only part one of a two-part series. In the next episode, I will not be so generous to Tina Brown. We will step into the moment when Tina Brown's long history of trauma, addiction, rage, you've heard it, finally erupts into an act of violence so severe that the details strain belief. There is a reason why she sits on Florida's death row. which is not common for women prisoners. The crime she committed is almost unimaginable. It is the culmination of decades of darkness converging into a single, catastrophic act. It is the point where the pain she carried stopped turning inward and instead broke outward in a sudden flood, leaving devastation in its path. Before we move on, I want you to remember this. True crime often tempts us to isolate the event from the life. It invites us to focus on the shock, the brutality, the aftermath. But behind every horrific act is a chronology of wounds that began long before the crime itself. Tina Brown's story forces us to confront that uncomfortable truth. It forces us to see how a lifetime of harm can build towards something much, much worse. In part two, we will enter that moment. We will examine the night when everything fractured. It will not be easy to hear. It is a story soaked in despair and violence. But it is also a story that demands to be understood, not because it offers comfort, but because it refuses it. Thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning. One of my earliest memories of my father is being told he was dead. I asked my mother where Daddy was. She told me he died in a car accident. I must have been 4 or 5 years old. One morning, I woke up, opened the front door of the apartment, and found a package addressed to me from Dad. It was 4 Disney VHS: The Little Mermaid, The Rescuers, The Great Mouse Detective, Fantasia. I was told that day that my dad was in fact alive, but that I would never see him again. They went through a bad split. My mom told me that when she found out he was cheating, she went for a drive and sprayed every one of his colognes out of the car window. For years, the only memory I had of my father were those VHS and the memories of finding them. I spoke to him for the first time when I was 20 years old. We spent days catching up on the phone, and I found out that we were a lot alike. We both were gifted readers from a young age. Both had severe flat feet, struggled with depression and anxiety. Both of us were into basketball. We even shared a lot of the same worldviews. It all sounds corny now, I'm sure, but it was exciting for me. We talked every day on the phone for weeks. Then one day, he stopped answering the phone, stopped returning my calls. It took me around a week to realize that I'd been abandoned by him again. I didn't have it in me to be too disappointed. Hillard had told me who he was all those years ago when I was just a little kid asking my mom where Daddy was. It was me who didn't get the message the first time. Something about true crime that interests me is the honesty of the medium, voyeuristic by nature. The message is often nowhere to be found. As a storyteller, I can recount to you the various ghoulish crimes committed by evil men and women, but there is a connection made between myself and the listener, an agreement that you, listener, are left to unpack the wreckage of what you just heard. True crime feels like a room with the lights off and the door locked from the outside. You sit in the dark long enough and your eyes adjust, but nothing becomes clear. Shapes stay warped. Corners stay crowded with things you do not want to name. Listener, I think about how often the dead are reduced to fragments. A smile in a yearbook, a grainy photograph, a last known phone call. They are all flattened into evidence and archived grief, pinned down so we can trace the outline and feel like we understand something. Something about the pain that haunts the memories of those left to remember. There is a comfort in the pattern of it, the way the story usually moves. Childhood, escalation, a breaking point, the act, the aftermath. It feels clean in structure, even when it's grimy in detail. A predictable architecture built from unpredictable damage. It reminds me of how people talk about serial killers. They speak about them like they fell from the sky, alien and unrecognizable. But most of the time, they were just people who woke up, brushed their teeth, and blended into grocery store aisles. Normality is not a disguise. It is the natural habitat. Writing these stories feels less like fear and more like recognition. The kind you do not admit to. The quiet thought that says that it is not foreign. This is not distant. This is close enough for you to touch. close enough to breathe it in, then maybe, listener, if you or I had a rougher childhood, just a tad more unkempt, unclean, we'd be the subject of a true crime podcast episode ourselves. Victims are always described by what they were before the worst thing that ever happened to them ended their story. Loving daughter, aspiring artist, quiet neighbor, they lit up the room. It feels like building a shrine out of adjectives, hoping language can retroactively give them a softer ending. It never works out. The ending is always louder than the life they left behind, and there is no catharsis found in it. Only a low-grade ache that settles in your chest and the recesses of your mind and will never leave. Justice feels like a word people say because they are afraid of silence. Prison sentences do not make time behave differently. Years do not reverse anything. They just accumulate dust. Sometimes I think the genre survives because it reassures us that suffering can be organized, filed, narrated, turned into episodes and chapters and series. It gives us the illusion that horror can be contained by runtime. It cannot. It just waits politely for the next play button. I hear my own voice when I tell these stories. It can sound detached, like it belongs to someone else. The words come out measured and even. I describe blood, fear, regret. They land softly. Maybe that's the point. To drain the color from it until it looks like something safe to study, so that it appears clearly and not darkly. In the end, true crime offers no lesson and no warning. It just reflects the same dull truth back at us. People break. People disappear. Love fails. The world continues without hesitation, indifferent to who it lost and why. That brings me back to my father. Had he stayed with my mom, I would have avoided the severe abuse piled onto me from age 4 to 13. Perhaps at 13, I wouldn't have attempted to murder my first stepfather. He left grasping his throat, face purple, and desperately sucking in air, after I had come seconds away from separating him from his life. But then, to add to that, maybe I wouldn't be here now, with my daughter, Cody, and my wife, Samantha. Maybe I wouldn't have a podcast full of listeners that have shown me so much love through the years. Listener, I do not like to admit that the darkest parts of me also built the safest parts of my life. It feels wrong to say that violence and absence carved out space for tenderness later. It feels like giving credit to the things that only ever took from me. But I cannot deny that I am still here, that my family is here, that you are here, listener. There are nights when I watch my daughter sleeping and think about how fragile the world really is, how thin the line is between breaking someone and protecting them, how easy it would be to let the past repeat itself if I had been made weaker or more tired. And still, I easily wake up every morning, choose to be gentle. I think that is the quiet truth the genre never touches. Not the gore, not the motive, not the trial. The truth is that most of us live our lives balanced on the edge of our worst instincts, and most of us choose to step back instead of forward. That is not dramatic, it does not sell, but it is real. When I speak into a microphone now, I imagine a room that is no longer locked from the outside. The lights are still low, but there is a hand on the doorknob. There is a small promise that it can be opened, that someone else is in here with me. Breathing, listening, surviving. I used to think honesty was only found in the ugliest details, in the blood and the fear, the broken endings. Now I think honesty also lives in the quiet spaces. My father is still a ghost in the background of my life. He always will be. He was absence. He was silence. He was a cautionary shape in a dark room. Now I have a child who smiles when she sees me. I have a wife who trusts me with her secrets. I have strangers who hear my voice and may find something of themselves in it, perhaps even kinship. That does not erase what happened, does not fix the past, but it builds something real in the present. Maybe that's enough. Not redemption. Not justice. Just continuation. Just a steady hand on a small back. Just a promise kept quietly, day after day, that the story does not have to end where it began. What matters is in the here and now. And the rest is just ephemera.